Human Services to order as a subcommittee this morning for the purpose of taking public testimony. We'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1290. Senator Starr is here, and is Michael Howden here? Okay, so you two are the only ones signed up here, so. Go right ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm State Senator Charles Starr, Senate District 5. Introduced a bill here which I think has great significance and no cost. The bill, Senate Bill 1290, is intended to ask the question, how does what we do as state government affect the stability and function of the family? I believe it's clear from the information that I know about that strong families reduce the cost to society of many of the programs that we as citizens have to finance. And so that if we can do anything at all that will make the family stronger and to function and nurture better the children that they bring into this world, we should decrease the cost of mediating or remediating the problems generated by broken families. So we've with this bill have asked the agencies of state government to consider how their actions, their policies and rules that they promulgate affect family in seven areas. And those are spelled out in the bill, how they strengthen the family unit, whether it erodes the authority or the rights of the parents, or the action helps the family perform its functions, whether the actions of the government increases or decreases family earnings, and if the proposed benefit of such actions is greater than the cost to the family, if the activity can be carried out by a lower level of government or by the family itself, and the message intended or otherwise the program sends to the public concerning the status of the family, and finally the message that the action sends to young people concerning the relationship between their behavior, their personal responsibility, and the norms of our society. We, of course, have seen some rather tragic events perpetrated by young people in our own state and in Colorado recently, and the message that we send to young people about their personal responsibility, personal self-government, I think is extremely important, but also in the same regard, how does this action affect the parents' responsibility or the nurture and upbringing of their children. And finally, the Act specifies that this action by state government is not intended to create a right or a benefit substantial or procedural enforceable at law by parties against the state. So, not a very big club, but certainly an opportunity to direct our state agencies to consider their impact on the family. I think it's a very important thing that we could do with this bill, and I urge your support. We'd be glad to answer questions as I'm able.
Yes, Senator.
Thank you. Well, thank you, Senator, for this walking us through the bill here. I very much support us doing whatever we can to invest in families in our state. I think that's absolutely what we should put a lot of effort into. I do have one question about line 21, the term and the norms of our society. What is your exact interpretation of the norms of our society here? How are we to interpret what that is?
That's always a difficult question, I think. I think the norms of our society is perhaps something that's to some extent in the eye of the beholder.
Mm-hmm.
But I think honesty and integrity and good citizenship are things that are fairly easily understood, and these are the kinds of things that I think we'd look to as norms of society.
Okay. Thank you.
Michael Howden has come in.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Michael Howden. I'm with the Oregon Center for Family Policy, and I too want to speak on behalf of the bill and appreciate the fact that you're giving it time and consideration. In my testimony there, I noted a couple of quotes there at the top of the page. I'd like to read for the record the top one. Unless we work to strengthen the family, to create conditions under which most parents will stay together, all the rest, schools and playgrounds and public assistance and private concerns, will never be enough to cut completely to the circle of despair and deprivation. And it's our view that this legislation would go a long ways towards strengthening that entire question. How can we make families not only more strengthened, but also more independent and better able to assimilate into their communities? In a 1986 federal report issued, and it was called The Family Preserving America's Future, it was noted in the report that government does not create the family, though it has an obligation to protect it. And government cannot abolish the family or intrude upon its functions without undermining the social foundation of the state itself. We believe, even though that was a federal report, that that's a similar concern for most states around the country as well. And we believe that's not because the issue of government is bad. In fact, our organization believes that government is good, and that it's an important aspect of our lives and should be reinforced. It's really a matter of a question of good government practices. And I would note at this point that we can look all across the state and understand that we have science classes, county planning sessions, private property development concerns, and state agencies all across the state that are asking questions about how our ecosystems are going to be affected by various questions regarding state practices and agency rules. If we can ask this question about a vital concern within the environmental issues, as well as within financial considerations with fiscal impact statements, it seems to us that it's logical then to ask the question about how policies and rules are affecting the dynamics of family growth. From a perspective of just environmental concerns, it would seem that from the perspective of the overall state environment, it's certainly how our families are doing and how they'll be impacted by agency practices and rules is a valid question. So we applaud your interest and attention to this bill. And we've also provided some possible questions at the end of our testimony that could be entertained or at least bring up some subjects that may be worthwhile considering down the line when this kind of practice, should this kind of practice be put into place. So we appreciate your attention and respectfully encourage you to vote in the affirmative to send this to the full floor in the Senate. Thank you very much.
Thank you. For the questions?
Are we in work session?
No, but I'm going to, we were just in a subcommittee
Sure. For
testimony purposes. I'm going to go ahead and open the full committee, the full committee status. So we're on Senate Bill 1290.
Is this just one factor?
No, apparently that's not the intention of the...
Well, I'll ask the question. question.
Go ahead, Senator.
Are there other states that do this? You may have said that.
I do know that right now it's being considered by a number of states, and unfortunately I couldn't get that for you, Senator Shannon and Chair of the Committee. I couldn't get that for you before this morning, before this time, but I will get that and provide it for you.
Another question?
Yes, Senator Shannon.
Wasn't this instituted by the federal government on federal law?
Chairman Fisher and Senator Shannon, it was approved originally by President Ronald Reagan in 1986. And was in effect until 1997 when President Clinton rescinded the order.
Okay.
I'm going to close the public hearing and open the work session on Senate Bill 1290. Senator Starr, I know your time is valuable. Would you wish to carry this bill?
I would.
I saw it. All right, fine. I'll
okay.
Put you down.
I move.
Senator Shannon?
Yeah, I move Senate Bill 1290 to the floor with a DuPont recommendation.
Senator Shannon has moved Senate Bill 1290 to the floor with a DuPont recommendation. Is there further discussion? Questions? Objections?
Mr. Chair,
yes,
I just want to make a statement before we vote
certainly.
On it. I don't really feel that, I mean, I'm going to support this. I think once again, anytime we can make a statement in support of families, it's absolutely important for us to do it. I don't think this is necessary. I think this is what we try and do all the time. If you look at all of the various government services that we have, they're all aimed at trying to make investments in the people of our state and try to help families. And so I think we already are doing this. A reminder and an official statement that we should really be making an extra effort to do it doesn't hurt. And so I'm going to support it.
Thank you for the statement. I guess due to a good many of the letters across my desk, it wouldn't hurt to have a reminder.
Senator?
Yes, Senator Shannon.
I'm going to support it because I think sometimes there are unintended circumstances, and this might help families to appeal when administrative rules are being made. Do you realize how this will impact our families?
Any further objections? Statement? Hearing none, will the clerk call the roll?
Senator
Castillo?
Aye.
Senator Duncan?
Aye.
Senator
Shannon? Aye.
Senator Shannon?
Aye.
Aye. Motion carries, and Senator Starr will be the carrier of the bill, and we will go. Is still don't have Senator Frayhill. Can we go on to 611?
Yeah.
Sure. Close the work session on Senate Bill 1290 and open the work session on Senate Bill 611.
Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 611. It affects the State Board of Directors of Liquor. I just, once again, this is going to be one of those days where I just got the amendments back. We have the dash three amendments. We've already had before us the dash one amendments, which required a confirmation of all board members. And the dash 3 incorporates the dash 2, which is allowing the board to accept and extend donation, contribution, and grant funds. The dash 3 is increasing the fees for midwives.
Okay.
We are here, so.
Are any of these amendments covering other amendments, or are they all individual? Well, no. Do the threes include the twos?
Yes.
Do the twos include the ones?
No, the twos are included in the dash threes. There was an issue raised with the last hearing from Sue Wilson in regards to approving the budget and then the board being shifted or expanded by a specific date. Legislative Council, in addressing that request, said that that's not appropriate until it goes to Ways and Means and the budget is addressed over there. So that amendment is not incorporated anywhere, even though we submitted it for the committee.
And that was, again, the...
Well, that was just another issue that was raised at the last hearing that we were to generate amendments on, and it just was not appropriate at this time to do that and to do it through this committee.
Okay.
All this amendment is doing is allowing them to accept and extend the nation's contributions and raising their license fee up to
change
it from $500 to $2,000. Mayor?
Mr. Chair, do you want a motion to adopt?
I think the next one also was allowing Senate confirmation.
All of that contained in three?
No. We need one and three.
One and three.
Right.
Okay, so I do them together. Dash one and three amendments.
Senator Duncan has moved that we accept the dash one and the dash three amendments to Senate Bill 611. Further discussion? Hearing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Shield.
When it places a $2,000 cap, I'm assuming that once, if the organization grows, the size of the organization, in other words, the funding base expands, and if they get past the current fiscal crisis, this permits them to lower the fee. This fee would move up and down depending on the needs. Am I correct in that understanding?
Yes, this is just a cap, and okay. I think we've had ample testimony on prior hearings that they have confidence in the board and that would be the direction.
I was asking for clarification and to have that clearly on the record. Having said that, I'd move Senate Bill 611 as amended to the floor if it do pass recommendation. Oh, it has to go to Ways and Means? Okay. The Ways and Means with the do pass recommendation.
Senator Shields recommends that we send Senate Bill 611 as amended with the dash one and dash three amendments to the Ways and Means Committee. Further discussion? Objections? Hearing none, will the clerk call the roll? Or will we call the clerk? We're not in a hurry or anything this morning, Sam.
Senator Duncan.
Aye.
Senator Shannon?
Aye.
Senator Shields?
Aye.
Senator Castillo?
Aye.
Chair Fisher?
Aye. Motion carries. I guess we don't have to have a carry on this since it goes to Ways and Means. Again, I want to thank the members of the midwifery group for their willingness to come and work out, and I certainly wish you well as you approach a real difficult time in your history here. I hope that things go better from here on out, and we'll, I guess, continue to work on this in the Ways and Means, and hope that we won't leave any stone unturned to find ways to help your organization. And again, thank you for your dedication, and I hope you don't mind if I once in a while refer to you as a rather outstanding example of what our boards could be like. Thank you very much. And again, we certainly wish you well. And you have a very nice article in the paper this morning. Or over the weekend, excuse me. I read it this morning. Close the work session on Senate Bill 611 and open a. Yes, we have Senator Ferry over here, so I will open the public hearing on Senate Bill 1156. Senator Ferry.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My intention to bring some amendments before the committee that will refocus Senate Bill 1156 to solve a problem that was disclosed from our folks at the Oregon Hospitals Association and the folks that administer the Oregon Health Plan. One of the problems that we had is we had a wrong site for the ORSs, and that wrong site connected our bill with third-party reimbursements from insurance companies. And if you can imagine the universe of pain that you enter when you start to talk about third-party reimbursements.
And we understand a little bit about that in this committee.
I can imagine you do, Chairman. The in fact, in point of fact, by changing the citation of the ORSs, we can talk about reimbursements to an individual from an organization or a community organization, not an insurance company, not a person with liability. And that can relatively be easily exempted from the income calculations for the family. And my understanding is that those amendments will be ready at 3 o'clock this afternoon, and I'll have them for the committee as soon as they'll be, the ink will still be wet, Mr. Chairman, when I get them to the committee. Then.
Well, we could look forward perhaps to doing a work session on this. I'll get special permission to have that session on Wednesday.
Mr. Chairman, I would very much appreciate that because this is a situation I think we can help some people resolve an issue, and it'll...
Why don't you just briefly explain, give us a...
In concept, Mr.
Yeah,
Chairman?
Yeah, right, and so that the staff or the committee and staff has a little idea.
Mr. Chairman, committee, the bill that I was bringing forward would have allowed a community organization to raise funds for a victim of an injury or an illness and have those funds held at a third-party bank and be dispersed on behalf of the victim of the illness or the injury, used to defray needful and necessary expenses without having that fund calculated as family income. And the problem we're trying to solve is that occasionally when those dollars are raised, they are calculated into family assets, and that can render the family ineligible for support under the Oregon Health Plan. And certainly, you know, an outpouring of support from the community for an injury or an accident victim or an illness victim shouldn't preclude that family from accepting the services of the Oregon Health Plan if they otherwise would qualify.
And obviously the donors have a specific purpose in mind, too. They're not wanting to have those things spent.
Right. It could be for...
There have been problems occasionally when that's happened, when those monies have been appropriated wrongfully by... members of the family for other things other than what the donations were given for.
There have been, for instance, there's been cases where mobility was an issue and folks got together to put a special equipment in a van for a wheelchair recipient and raised the money and in fact invalidated that person's long-term care for a period of time until those assets were spent down on the care and not the special need. So there is a relatively easy fix for this, and it has to do with fixing the ORSs that we cited in the original bill.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. We'll look forward to having a work session on it on Wednesday, and I will make that application to do that.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1156 and open a work session on Senate Bill 919. Catherine White and James Page. Go right ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Catherine White with the Oregon Developmental Disabilities Council, and I'm here on behalf of the Developmental Disabilities Coalition, which is a coalition of all the major advocacy and provider organizations in the state. And we are proposing the -1 amendment to Senate Bill 919. In the 1995-1997 interim, the disability community, both local government, advocates, and providers, developed the long-range plan, which was a plan to sort of restructure the system for people with developmental disabilities in Oregon. And despite a great deal of accomplishment with that long-range plan, there are still thousands of individuals with developmental disabilities who do not receive services. And we believe that it's time to begin an additional discussion and planning process that involves all the stakeholders in the developmental disability system to to look at such issues as eligibility, prioritization of services, and look at our whole service system from that perspective. We know that it is unlikely that there will ever be enough money to serve all the people with developmental disabilities in Oregon, and we believe that we need to do a better job of looking at how we prioritize those individuals who receive services, look in a planful way at how people get access to 24-hour services. Right now, we don't have that kind of similar structure to our system. And let me give you an example of some of the issues that we would like to have some exploration of. If a person has a developmental disability, cerebral palsy, and requires a great deal of personal assistance services, and they have an IQ that puts them slightly above the level of mental retardation, they're served through the senior and disabled services system and entitled to a certain level of personal assistance support. If, in fact, they have the very same care needs, but their IQ goes below the level that is considered mental retardation, they are not entitled to any services and, in fact, may spend years on the wait list. This is a process that is being reviewed around the country, looking at levels of services. We're proposing that a planning group be developed during this interim to look at how the system is structured to assure that what we are doing, in fact, is providing equitable services around the state, and that, in fact, we have some very clear guidelines and understanding of who should receive services throughout the state. And as I say, this is an issue just because of our baby boom population. This is an issue that every state in the nation is confronting. And we believe that we need to take a very planful approach and build on what was already done during the long-range planning process. The advocates feel very strongly about this process and are willing to commit both staff time and resources to make sure that this kind of discussion occurs in a very planful way.
Yes, Senator Castillo.
Thank you. Thanks, Catherine, for your testimony. In your written testimony, that you say here that Oregon has one of the largest wait lists in the country. Can you tell me what's going on with that? Is it that we don't provide enough funds for those programs, or what is it?
Mr. Chair, Senator Castillo, that data is based on per capita. We're a small state, and so in terms of growth numbers, our wait list is smaller. We also collect data that many states don't collect in terms of access to services. This study was done by the National ARC in looking at data that was available around the country. That being said, we also have invested in previous years extensively in our institution, and we frankly have not seen the kind of investment in general fund dollars into developmental disabilities programs the way other states have done for lots of fiscal reasons in Oregon.
Thank you. So just so I'm clear on basically what the goal of this legislation is, then it take advantage of the opportunity as we're phasing out Fairview and moving more people out into the community, and these changes are underway, and we're looking at how we're going to be using funds that may become available to help people on the wait list. This bill says let's also take a look at what it is we're doing, and then you kind of lay out how we should go about doing that in this legislation. Is that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Castillo, yes. I believe that under the long-range plan, what we did was restructure the big system, reprioritized our efforts from institutions into communities, and moved that. Now we need to look at the system that actually serves those individuals in the community, not people who've been in institutions, but families who are struggling and our extensive wait list. If we were to provide the same level of service to everyone that we can identify right now, and we were to provide 24-hour services for those individuals, we'd be looking at budgets into $200 and $300 million of additional general fund. We know that's not feasible. We need to take a real serious look in light of our new approaches to providing in-home supports, how we decide who gets those supports, what level of those supports are there, how do we identify the most disabled within our state and get them the level of supports that are needed. Thank you.
Catherine, you said something about mentioned a group to study this, and I only see in here that it would be the Mental Health and Development Disability Services Division shall develop the plan. It doesn't say anything about a group. Were you intending to have them have members of the general public or the providers or other people involved in that?
Mr. Chair, on in Section 1, Sub 3, in developing the plan, the division shall work with affected parties, including but not limited to consumers, families, providers, advocates, contractors, county developmental disability programs, and other partners.
I wasn't sure just what life you meant to work. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for the question. We do want to work very closely with the Office of Developmental Disability Services. We'll be tracking them closely.
All right. Okay. Oh, excuse me.
Mr. Chairman, very quickly, James Hayes from the Mental Health and Developmental Disability Services Division. We just wanted to briefly state for the record that we have not submitted a fiscal impact on this, and we'll develop the plan if the legislature adopts this policy direction within our existing staff and resources. But I wanted to clarify that we have some pretty big remaining issues on our plate, including the long-range plan and the transfer of kids from SDF to our division. So as we've discussed with the advocates and the providers, the type of planning effort we would undertake would look at existing waiting list information, population demographics, some projections, sample probably some model approaches in different states that have looked at capitation and some other ways of trying to assure some minimum level of support for everyone who's eligible, and that we won't have the capacity to go out and do a comprehensive assessment of everybody on the waiting list. I think there are some people that feel we ought to do a very thorough analysis of every single individual and family on the waiting list, and we simply want to say we don't have the capacity to do that. If that was the planning direction, we would have to request staff and the resources, but if everyone understands the context in which we can undertake this plan using average rates and some population studies and some sampling of other states, then we think we can do it within existing resources.
I'm just curious, does that meet your needs?
Mr. Chair, Senator Duncan. yes, I think that we also have made a commitment within the Developmental Disabilities Coalition to put in resources as well. So where we see them falling down in terms of what we would like to see in terms of additional data, we've made that commitment to come up with that ourselves as well.
Any questions? Hearing none.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I see. We have this would declare an emergency, and then how soon would we have this information then, you think?
Mr. Chair, Senator Castillo, on sub 4 of Section 1, the plan shall be presented during the interim no later than February 1st.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, with the Gas 1 amendment, it removed the emergency clause.
Yeah.
The amendment does not happen.
And just fixed the timeline.
Right.
Okay.
Does that mean that that would be a relatively short time then when the bill goes in effect, unless something was started prior to that, because if this goes the regular normal route, it might not be in effect until November. That would only be between November and February 1. If you do a study, that is much time.
Mr. Chair, we can discuss whether we would be able to start that or look at adding that emergency clause on the House side.
All right.
And on the other hand, they can see the train coming. I mean, no reason to wait until some magic date out there to start.
Sure, you ready? I'll move the dash one amendment. Right. We're in this session.
Yeah. Yeah.
I will get there right quick. Close the public hearing and open a work session on Senate Bill 919.
I move the dash one
in work session on that, but
I move the dash one amendment. Yeah.
Senator Duncan moves the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 919. Further discussion? Objection? So ordered.
I move 919 is amended to the floor of the due pass recommend. No, not due pass. What do you mean?
If they're willing to take it in.
Okay, within their own budget. Okay, I move it to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Duncan moves Senate Bill 919 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there further discussion? Objections? Hearing none, will the clerk call the roll?
Senator Steele?
Aye.
Senator Steele?
Aye.
Senator Duncan?
Aye.
Chair Pitcher?
Aye. Motion carries. Do we have a carrier for this one?
Oh, go ahead. It's one.
Pick one.
I don't care.
You like decision making this way, don't you?
Okay, we'll give this one to Senator Shield.
Yep.
Glad to have it. Don't want to steal it from Senator Duncan.
Oh, no, that's not.
Close the work session on Senate Bill 919, and we're going to go to working on that. Okay. Have a work session here on Senate Bill 941. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 941 is creating a residential treatment program and outpatient treatment program for individuals with dual diagnoses of mental health illnesses and substance use disorders. Senate Bill 941 is at the request of the Department of Justice. We previously have a companion bill, Senate Bill 942, that we referred to the Senate Committee on Judiciary. The department is supportive of putting this companion bill with that bill in Senate Judiciary. So we are just bringing it forward to take a motion or take action of transferring it to the Senate Committee on Judiciary.
Senate Bill 942 dealt primarily with rehabilitating prisoners and people in the actual prison system, the correction system, and this is dealing with ones outside the correctional system, basically, and doing about the same thing. So that gives a brief idea of what this is about.
And all we're doing is just giving the recognition?
Right? Some information here?
No,
it's just going to the judiciary to work out the...
It does have a prior reference to ways and means after it gets, you know, worked and things like that, because there is appropriate money.
Because he wants to move it to
judiciary.
I move that we send Senate Bill 941 to the Judiciary Committee. With recommendation? What do you want?
941.
Do we want a recommendation in due pass or just without recommendation?
Without recommendation. Senator Duncan has moved that we send Senate Bill 941 to the judiciary without the recommendation.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Shields.
Can we discuss this for just a second?
Sure.
I have a basic question, and I don't know if there's anybody in the audience that can answer this, but before I resigned my pastorate in Portland, there was an agency in our neighborhood that dealt with chronically mentally ill people. Some of them would have developmental disabilities as well, but about 80 or 90% of them also had a drug or alcohol problem. And the comment that they made to me was that people in developmental disabilities would say, you know, we don't want them because they got a drug or alcohol problem. And over at the other end, the drug and alcohol people would say, we don't want them because they got a developmental disability or they got a mental illness or whatever, and they're not appropriate for the program. And so the people ended up being kind of batted back and forth. Is this bill going to address that kind of local kind of real problem? And there's number one, and number two, is there am I off base? Is this got nothing to do with that issue?
Yeah, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we have Mark Gardner from the Department of Justice here, so might be able to address your question.
I just saw a relationship, and maybe I'm off base. I don't know.
Senator Fisher, members of the committee, Senator Shields, your comment is very well taken. This is a very serious problem because, in my experience as a circuit court judge in Washington County, these people are kind of falling through the cracks. You know, there are programs, good programs for people with mental illness. There are good programs for people that have alcohol and drug problems. But there are very few programs for people that have both. And this was basically the intent of the legislation to create some treatment facilities that would be specifically for these people.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Chief.
In an experimental way, at least in Southeast Portland, there is one such program in an embryonic stage, and I'd like to talk to somebody about that program and maybe get some testimony from them to judiciary. Where would I go to pursue that?
Chairman Fisher, Senator Shields, I'd be glad to, if we're able to get a hearing in the Judiciary Committee, which I think we will, I'd be glad to take that name of the person, if it was given to me, or organization, and make sure that they were notified of the hearing.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you, Mr. Gardner. Appreciate it. Further questions or discussion? Clerk, call the roll.
Chairman Shields?
Aye.
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 Motion carries. Close work session on Senate Bill 941 and open a work session on Senate Bill 974. We have some amendments on being offered on Senate Bill 974. Scott Gallant, would you care to discuss those?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Scott Gallant. I'm with the Oregon Medical Association. When this bill was for the committee last, the testimony basically centered around the ability of nurse practitioners in Oregon to catch up to other states regarding prescriptive privileges for Schedule II medications. We provided the committee with a letter in a national update of the ability of nurse practitioners to use Schedule II drugs. The large majority of states, and we also provided this to the ONA, most of the states require a collaborative arrangement with physicians for Schedule II medications. Some of the testimony before the committee used some examples of instances where it would be appropriate for nurse practitioners to prescribe Schedule II medications. One was, for example, the emergency room department, where a typical patient, I think the examples that were used was for two fractures patients. Obviously, a diagnosis is first appropriate to determine what is causing the pain involved in those circumstances. Obviously, physicians are involved in that, as are nurses and others. And this merely would say that there would have to be some collaborative working arrangement with, obviously, the emergency room physicians for these particular patients. Another example, I believe, that was used was a radiological oncologist who was treating a patient Typically, there are a battery of physicians involved with those particular patients, both including oncologists as well as surgeons and others, where there is, in fact, ready access to pain medication for those particular patients. Again, this proposed amendment merely would require that there be a collaborative arrangement between nurse practitioners and physicians for the treatment of these patients so that you have continuity of care. You most certainly would not want to prescribe medication that would be inappropriate for a patient who obviously would already have prescriptive medications for their particular pain. So essentially, the Dash 1 amendments say that there would be agreements between physicians and nurses in a collaborative arrangement for the prescription of Schedule II medications, which are typically used in very serious circumstances. They can be very addictive, and we think this corresponds to authority throughout the rest of the country. I'll be happy to answer any questions, Mr. Chair, if you have any.
Okay, thank you. You may want to stick around with me. Brian Delation, if you want to.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Brian Delashman, representing the Oregon Nurses Association, and I have Susan King with me with the Oregon Nurses Association. Let me make a comment or two first, and then I'll let Susan kind of address maybe some of Mr. Gallant's comments. All of you have probably been by now provided or in your file have seen a fact sheet that the Oregon Nurses Association has distributed on this bill. If not, we'll try and get you another copy. But let me pick up a couple of points that are on that that sheet. I know you're searching for them. They were actually supplied to your office last
year.
So you may or may not have them.
Don't know that you got them at home.
Put in your file. The type of relationship that Mr. Gallant is proposing in the Dash 1 amendment is 20 years old. That was what the arrangement was in 1977. I kind of again find myself in the situation of being a historian. Because I've been here since 1977 and then 79 session. But in 1977, the Oregon legislature had a relationship like this between physicians and nurse practitioners, and they came back and changed it in 1979 for one primary reason, that there was a situation in Condon and other places around the state in which there was requirement of a written kind of contractual agreement or arrangement between a nurse practitioner and a physician, and a physician in the Dalles was charging a nurse practitioner in Condon, and I believe the figure at the time was $18,000 a year for that arrangement. That basically drove the nurse practitioner out of Condon, and Condon was left without a provider. We've evolved since then. We've gone through a number of different kind of arrangements since 1979 in which there was a formulary council made up of pharmacists, nurse practitioners, and physicians. That was then dismissed in the mid to early 80s. We've moved now to the point where nurse practitioners basically have the ability to prescribe through the Board of Nursing up to Schedule II. So we've kind of gone through this whole thing historically since the 70s, and what this amendment would do is throw us back to 1977 in which you'd have to have that written arrangement. And we believe that it's unnecessary. And with that, we'd like to reject the Dash 1 amendment.
Just to add some brief comments, my name is Susan King, a registered nurse staff person with the Oregon Nurses Association. I actually was on the joint committee between the Board of Nursing and the Board of Medical Examiners for 2 years until, in 1987, the legislature concluded that nurse practitioners should have sole authority under the Board of Nursing. So I do, have experience with the joint regulation, which, as Brian said, was rejected by the legislature over a decade ago. Another couple of points. Mr. Gallant, I think, concluded that much of our testimony related to bringing us up to the standards of other states. That's not my memory of the information that we provided to you during the hearing. In fact, it's unusual for Oregon to have to be brought up to the standards of other states on a variety of issues, and this is one. The state of New Hampshire, for example, patterned their legislation after ours. So many states are desiring and moving towards moving up to our standards rather than the other way around. So would these amendments, or should they be adopted, it would certainly reflect a regression in our standards, and we would again urge you not to support them. Thank you.
Just 1 second. I have a question. Nurse practitioners have the right to prescribe a class one, or no, class three and four, or whatever it is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Three, four, and five, yeah.
Can you describe for the record the difference between those three, four, and five and a class two? I'm not totally certain in my own mind. I know there's potential, I suppose, for dependency upon forming dependency upon some of these drugs. Also, I would gather that they probably are also something that would be possibly available or saleable on a legal basis. To folks with chemical dependence that wanted to continue that practice, and I would like to know how much more dangerous they are, for instance, as far as actual usage to the patient, because there are a lot of drugs on the schedule that you now are able to utilize that certainly could damage person's health if they were wrongly applied. So could you kind of just brief us on that?
Yes, Senator Fisher and members of the committee. The Schedule II drugs include drugs such as Demerol, morphine, Percodan. So typically you think of them as sort of the strongest of the, in terms of pain medication, in terms of pain relief. And clearly they have very strong addictive qualities. And that's part of the way drugs are classified is by their effect and by the addictive qualities in the Schedule IIs. Among the others, Schedule III, IV, and V are drugs which have high street value and equal addictive value. For example, Vicodin is a very commonly prescribed oral pain medication that we use a great deal in emergency room care, and that has a great street value. It's sought after, highly addictive, and yet nurse practitioners are currently prescribing that in limited quantities for short periods of time. So many of the drugs in the 3, 4, and 5 categories have both street value and addictive qualities. It's just the Schedule IIs are typically used in the example that we used and Mr. Gallant referred to, an acute injury where you have intense pain for a short period of time. A nurse practitioner, just like a physician, would probably order a 2 or 3 day supply of that very strong oral narcotic or even injectable narcotic, and then the patient would move on to something else, either one of the other scheduled drugs or onto Motrin or something like that. So the drugs that we are seeking have some very specific interventions. The secondary one, of course, is in the long-term management of acute and chronic pain in the terminally ill, in people with chronic pain, who have been well evaluated and well diagnosed so that their problems are understood.
Any further questions? Scott, do you wish to? No further.
Are we in a hearing or
a work session?
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Scott Gamble with the Oregon Medical Association. Let me first say that physicians and nurse practitioners do, in fact, work a great deal together, and I'm not trying to suggest that I'm trying to return the nurse practitioner's ability to practice back 20 years. That's most certainly not my intent. While for a change, I was not around in 1979, I have talked to Mr. Farney Spate a number of times, who was, in fact, in my position at that time, as well as almost everyone else's in the healthcare association business. But, you know, one of the primary motivations, as Mr. Gelassman mentioned, was for encouraging practitioners in rural areas, and the fact of the matter is that nurse practitioners are not in rural Oregon in any greater degree than one had hoped they would be today. But that aside, I think it is in fact important, particularly with patients who are terminally ill or who have very severe medical conditions, that there be a very clear relationship between physicians, primary care physicians, specialists, nurse practitioners, or others in the treatment of these patients. This legislation would, in fact, enable that to be assured if it is, in fact, adopted. Again, I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Yes, Senator. Yes.
Scott, I'm curious. Looking at the schedule, 3 and 4 drugs and so forth, I assume those are all monitored. Has there been any abuse or problem areas involved for this?
I have not researched that, to be honest with you. I do know that we discussed this a little bit. I think the nurse practitioners, someone from the board, indicated that they had not seen any particular excesses in abuse by nurse practitioners for schedules 3 through 4. But these are particularly dangerous and useful medications. I'm not trying to suggest, and I'm not sure, I'm not convinced that the decision of whether there have been disciplinary actions is really relevant to the particular issue. The issue is whether or not one has a strong collaborative connection where you have really batteries of practitioners involved in patient care for the most severely ill in the process. And there are most certainly mechanisms for that currently. But this goes another step in the sense of adding potentially another practitioner in prescribing medications where a patient is already receiving medications in the process. So, you know, whether or not there have been you know, disciplinary activities really isn't relevant to the issue.
My question, yesterday I was with a physician friend of mine who said, thank you, physicians over-prescribe those things too. So.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Duncan, I think we can all find anecdotal problems. And where those occur, it's most certainly unfortunate and inappropriate, and there are all kinds of mechanisms to address those. But again, this is really about how one coordinates care for patients who are in hospice, where you have medical directors and systems that are designed to make sure that appropriate care is occurring, or emergency rooms or other circumstances where you want to make sure that you have the highest level of patient care possible. Thank you.
You know, I guess I think some of these things are a bit relevant as to whether they've had problems, because I think when you're allotting opportunities for people to work in situations, you base it on their performance in the past. And if they have not been problematic, it is a pretty good indication that they may well be able to handle a little more responsibility and things too. If it has been problematic, then it's certainly an indication that perhaps something needs to be done the other direction. So I guess I would differ with you just a bit in my feeling of whether or not there have been particular problems or they've had to take disciplinary actions in the past over some of these other duties.
Mr. Chairman, I guess I'd have two responses. I would suspect that nurses or nurse practitioners have approximately the same disciplinary activities regarding the inappropriate use of medications that physicians would, and in the sense of inappropriately using, if they have access to medications, using those medications and becoming addicted to them themselves, as do physicians, and their programs, some based off of one that the Medical Association began a number of years ago to address that. The second response is that it's difficult to determine the whether or not someone will successfully or not use these particular medications when they've never had the authority to prescribe them in the first place. Now, what I said in my testimony earlier is that we have the greatest respect for nurse practitioners. We're not suggesting that they're not highly skilled, but that, in fact, it is very important that you coordinate the activities between these practitioners, particularly for these patients.
Mm-hmm.
Yes,
I don't mean to cut off discussion, but I move Senate Bill 974 to the 974 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Shin has moved Senate Bill 974 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. I want to ask another question. In your opinion, is the difference between a Class 3 drug and a Class 2 drug much more than a recognition of a problem drug on the street?
Mr. Chairman, yes, I believe it is.
Is it that, are those drugs that much more either powerful or reactionary or something and another than the drugs that are in the Class 3?
They are significant medications, highly addictive. They are drugs that are used for the most severely ill, diseased, or injured medications. This is serious prescriptive medication. Physicians are very cautious, Mr. Chairman, in the prescribing of these medications.
Are these things not also passed out with pretty much regularity on minor surgeries and things for follow-up for 2 or 3 days because of pain?
I don't believe that they would be lightly prescribed.
I didn't mean it to be lightly prescribed, but I mean they're very, very common.
They are used in order to address serious pain and if that's your question. I mean, they're not, it is not done without thought about prescribing these sorts of medications.
Okay. I just wanted to say something before we vote, and that is that I wouldn't even be, this is just to you, that I wouldn't even be considering this if I didn't think that the nurse practitioners had successfully completed the courses in pharmacy and that they explained to us. And I am also impressed with their track record, the cautiousness that they have acted under.
Well, I know from my own observation we made several little change of practice bills since I've been in the legislative process here since 1993, and I have yet to see anything that I think has been something that has turned out to be bad that we've had to come back and deal with.
and yet every single time we've approached it, there's been very hot and heavy discussion on both sides of the fence.
Mr. Chair. Thank you. I very much appreciate and respect Mr. Gallant's testimony on behalf of the OMA, but I do feel on this legislation that the nurses have made just a great case for their, I guess, qualifications and professionalism in being able to take on this added scope. And I feel very comfortable with this bill and feel that in no way is it compromising the safety of Oregonians in our state, so I'm ready to vote for this.
And I would note that there are several letters from the doctors very actively in the field that are dealing with these problems that express utmost confidence in the ability of the nurse practitioners to handle this particular situation, too. So, Senator Dunford,
no, I'm supporting.
Split the discussion. Objection. Hearing none, will clerk call the roll.
Senator Castillo?
Aye.
Senator Buckley?
Aye.
Senator Kennedy?
Aye.
Senator Shields?
Aye.
Senator Schiff?
Aye. Motion.
Okay.
Great. Yeah, Senator Shannon would like to carry the bill, and that's fine. We'll sign that to her. Okay. Close the work session on Senate Bill 974 and open a work session on Senate Bill 824. And I call Lisa Gilliam and Bruce Crawford.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this is a bill that's eliminating prior authorization for non-sedating antihistamines and nasal inhalers compared to participants in Oregon health plans. We are still refining language, so what I'm passing out is a draft from legislative council that we can adopt conceptually if all the parties agree, and then be able to finalize it and grow the bill. But that's why it says draft all over, because we made the changes this morning on it.
Okay. Go ahead and put your vote you wish.
Mr. Chair, for the record, I'm Hirsch Crawford with the Office of Medical Assistance Programs, and we're fine with the Dash 3 amendment.
Okay.
The thing marked grant?
Yes.
I'm having trouble finding my bill here. I'm sorry, this thing. I think I'm too far back. Okay, Lisa, you want to go ahead and...
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Lisa Scott Gilliam. The point of the amendments were to address the concerns of the committee that we couldn't list the diagnosis on the prescription, which would help us define whether the condition is above the line or below the line on the prioritized list. All of these conditions in severe form are above the line. They're covered on the list. And so the assumption is that when they see an allergist, that's a specialist. They've been referred by a primary care physician, which implies severity on the part of the patient. This helps us to cover the conditions that are on the prioritized list, but it doesn't cover the non-severe allergies that still fall below the line. And this allows us to do that without having to put the diagnosis on the prescription. So we also are fine with this.
Okay, so we would need to probably get these done and then review it, won't we?
We can adopt these.
We can.
And then they will issue the final, and then we can do the handling. We got full action on this both ways.
Okay, so...
Are we in a work session?
Yes.
Okay, I move the Dash 1 amendment.
Dash 3.
Dash 3 amendment.
Excuse me.
Okay, thank you. Dash 3 to Senate Bill 824.
Senator Shannon moves the Dash 3 amendments to Senate Bill 824. Further discussion? Objection? Hearing none, so ordered. But thank you both for working together on this. And I think that there are several folks out there that are going through some of these problems that will thank you also.
I want me to move it again?
Yes, that's fine.
I move Senate Bill 824 as amended to the floor of the DuPass recommendation.
You have to mention the idea that these are conceptual or...
Oh, you can just say the draft, yes.
Okay. You're not suspending rules, are you? Senator Shannon has moved Senate Bill 824 to the as amended by the draft of dietary amendments with a due pass recommendation. Further discussion? Objections? Hearing none, will the clerk call the roll?
Senator Duncan?
Aye.
Senator Kennedy?
Aye.
Senator
Kerr?
Aye.
Senator Castillo?
Aye.
Aye. Motion carries. And Senator Shannon will...
You want me to? I don't...
Oh, I...
Do
we send... Somebody. Let's see. We send this one to Senator Duncan, though.
Sure.
Which one are we doing? 873, 24.
Mm-hmm. I'm carrying it.
You mind?
Yeah. I don't mind. I don't care. I think I can...
Senator Duncan, carry Senate Bill 824. Okay, let's go ahead here with going to do a public hearing on Senate Bill 16.
Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 16 is establishing a requirement for a health benefit plan to provide direct access for eye care services to the optometrist. Once again, this morning we received the Dash 7 amendments that I am passing out to you. They have already been distributed in the back. Yeah, 7 amendments are basically just clarifying that covered eye care service for an emergency basis.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Also, this morning, the first time I saw them was the Dash 6 amendments, right? Those were distributed with our major summary. Right. Okay. Sorry, I mean, this is one of those bills where you weigh it by the pound as my folder's gotten thicker and thicker. I'm just trying to catch up with all the information that we've gotten in this. I'm kind of confused as to which roadmap we're using at this point. If we got choices of 1 through 7, I'd like some comments that would clarify.
Yeah, I think basically what the Day 7 amendments are about is to allow a person to be served by an optometrist or an ophthalmologist on an emergency basis for a one-time visit, and then it would have to go through the proper process after that one emergency visit. That's my understanding, and I'm going to allow some other folks to describe the Dash 6 amendments here, and I would call Wayne Schumacher from the Optometry Association, and if you have any with you that would...
Mr. Hurdle's Dash 7, whose amendments are those? Dash 7.
The Dash 7 amendments were at my request because we were trying to solve an emergency situation here, and we were kept going through around Robert Hood Barn to get there, and I wanted to
check. I was just curious for the record. And the 6 are yours,
and the 6 are from the Optometric Association.
Yeah. 6 and
Optometric. Go ahead, Wayne.
Senator Fisher, members of the committee, my name is Wayne Schumacher. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Optometric Association. It's interesting, I guess I must apologize on behalf of a number of folks who have provided it. As Senator Shields has said, you have to weigh this by the pound. The rhetoric has indeed surrounding this bill has mounted up by the pound, I think. Senate Bill 16 essentially was introduced to allow patients of managed eye care organizations or managed care organizations to access their choice of any medical eye care professional, not just optometry, but ophthalmology as well as their primary care physician. It's a choice. One of the things I think that's gotten lost in the rhetoric is two things. Is we have a study by Melman and Robertson that says direct access to eye care is indeed cost effective. There is a saving of 3 cents per member per month. Number two is I think we've forgotten the patient in all of this. If we were to adopt the Dash 7 amendment for an emergency only, two things are very plain. One is, what is an emergency? It's not defined. And number two is, when you do have someone that comes in on a Saturday afternoon because they've gotten a piece of debris in their eye from blowing a lawn, typically the rule of thumb in eye care is you never let the sun set twice on a attached eye. They need to be seen the next day. Where do they be? Where are they going to be seen? In an emergency facility? We cannot get usually a referral from a primary care physician on a weekend. Those are two issues that are a real problem with the Dash 7 amendment. Dash 6 amendment, we believe, provides the best possible language. Essentially, new language on page 1 clarifies that the names of any participating eye care practitioner be included in the health plan's panel for eye care services and should be included as an addendum to the list of primary care providers distributed to enrollees. Opponents were concerned that the eye care practitioners had been included in the actual list of primary care providers, and it would have caused, but would not be included, and it would cause confusion to enrollees. They couldn't determine who's the eye care provider they can go to under the panel. Possibility they'd be going to somebody who doesn't belong on the panel. OOAs believe the sections requiring eye care professionals, regardless of the professional title, to receive similar payment for similar services, and that the health plan's network of providers ensures geographic possibility, accessibility for eye care practitioners. We've removed that. It's not necessary in the bill, we feel. We agreed with opponents on that. OOA has agreed to a limitation of 4 unreferred visits. We believe this is the proper way to go. After the initial visit, and even though Milner Robertson's study proved overwhelming evidence as to the cost savings involved when patients can access eye care practitioners, new language in Section 2, Paragraph 3, Item A, addressing deductibles and coinsurance, clarifies that the section includes vision care services. Excuse me, excludes vision care services.
Sir, I have a question.
Yes.
Wayne, I'm lost, sir.
Yes.
Where are we?
We are in section, new language in Section 2.
Of what?
On page 2, Section 2.
Harry Hamden Gross of March 26th, right?
This will be relevant to the Dash 6 amendment. And Dash 6 were just given to us this morning. No?
No. I'm sorry.
Okay.
I'm not finding the...
Well, Dash 6 was on my desk this morning. But this is what we were given this morning.
All right, but the Dash 6s were distributed last week at the last meeting that we did not get to, with the Hand and Growth bill.
So that's the Hand and Growth.
And the Hand and Growth was dated 4/27.
Mm-hmm. Hand and Growth 4/27.
Right there. Okay. On page 2.
Okay. It really makes the small one look the same place. I'm sorry.
No problem. No problem with folks. So in Section 3, Section 2, Paragraph 3, Item G, has been amended to modify, let me backtrack a minute. Have you caught up with this, Mr. Gensler?
Okay.
In Section 2, Paragraph 3, Item A, the new language addresses deductible and full insurances. Again, we've identified it to be that the section excludes vision care, so just dealing with medical eye care. Under Section 2, Paragraph 3, Item B, it's been amended to modify the restriction on hospital privilege requirements so that optometrists cannot be denied admission to a provider panel solely because their lack of having hospital privileges through panel membership could be denied optometrists on this basis. So we've modified that language. The OOA was also persuaded to remove language in Section 2, Item 4, which declared that nothing in the bill requires an insurer to provide eye care services in their benefit plan, nor vision care coverage, or prevent an enrollee from receiving eye care services from a primary care provider on the insurer's panel. Because, in fact, the bill does not include those mandates, this section was viewed as unnecessary. And Senate Bill 16, with the Dash 6 amendments, would still provide convenient, cost-effective eye care to the citizens of Oregon, yet preserve the role of managed care. While the large managed care organizations remain opposed to releasing any control over how they operate their benefit plans, in the case of eye care, patient access to eye care practitioners makes sense, economically and logically, when it comes to providing quality care. Members of the committee, I submit to you this is essentially the difference between big business and the managed care organizations trying to dictate what a patient can go and seek care. I'd be glad to answer any questions when I can.
Yes, Senator Shields.
We're just in hearing at this point.
Yes.
We're not in the room. I appreciated what was said about kind of the patient's concerns getting lost in all of the verbiage. And I appreciate the reminder of the savings under that Middleman and Robertson study. I'm sorry, I haven't been able to keep up with all this. I've been dashing too many places to keep up with all these dashes here. Kind of like the Dash 6 amendments, because of they're more comprehensive and address more issues than they have been, I think, listening to people and have dropped several provisions. Anyway, as we were all hustling to try and get various versions straight in our heads and in the paperwork in front of us, I would appreciate further consideration of Dash 6 at this point.
Okay, well, let's go on with the testimony. We've got folks here.
Sure.
Joey Fisher and Scott Young.
Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Jody Fisher with the Oregon Academy of Ophthalmology. We had worked in several work sessions with the optometrists to try and come up with some consensus amendments, and were unable to do that. We were trying to find a way to ensure that patients had access to eye care in emergency situations, or in the case where you're there for a visit for your eyeglasses and an optometrist or an ophthalmologist sees something that needs to be treated there on the spot, without in essence making optometrists primary care physicians. We think that the Dash 7 amendments that Chair Fisher has come up with, if you include the first line of the Dash 6 amendments, which deletes the language in 14 through 24 of the bill, all of the language that has to do with other than direct access, the Oregon Academy of Ophthalmology would support those amendments, and with them we would be neutral on the bill. And I must say that I admire Chair Fisher for his persistence, and I think he's done a good job in the Dash 7 amendments in getting to the nub of the problem here. So with the addition of deleting lines 14 through 24, we would support the Dash 7 amendments.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Scott Gallant. I'm with the Oregon Medical Association. We, too, would support the Dash 7 amendments for the reasons that were just provided. The idea of listing optometrists as an addendum to primary care providers makes really no sense. Primary care providers are typically family practice physicians, OB-GYNs, and others who have the ability to provide a wide variety of medical services, and I think would in fact be misleading to the public. So for that particular reason, we would support the Dash 7 amendments with modifications suggested.
Okay. There's been some suggestion that once a condition was started and then a specific reference was used to someone that came in on a Saturday, it would need to be seen. This could also happen, I'm guessing, around the 4th of July holiday, which would extend it to a potential three-day period. Labor Day might do the same. Memorial Day possibly could. Some of the Monday holidays. Christmas, New Year's, Thanksgiving, things like that that might have a time period there that would be rather difficult to buy it. Is the idea of having a follow-up ability, if it were put on the idea of weekends or holidays, is that something that is foreign to your thinking?
Well, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I would see in the advance of an amendment that the services of an eye care practitioner covered eye care services on an emergency basis. I would read into that as follow-up visits on an emergency basis. I mean, if it's over a 4th of July weekend, my guess is you could come and see on a follow-up basis. What I am concerned about in the DAS 6 amendments is that it guarantees, in addition to the first visit, another 4 visits to an optometrist. And my concern is that you could have a person with a serious eye care problem who gets treated without ever having seen a real medical doctor. So I think that a follow-up visit could certainly be covered by the language in DAS 7 if that's on an emergency basis.
Mr. Chairman, I would add as well, while some may suspect that physicians don't work through holidays or weekends, they do. Typically, groups have on-call requirements as to hospital facilities, clinics, and others. So the ability to get to an ophthalmologist in an emergency or get medical services in an emergency may not be as acutely unavailable as one might suspect.
I understand on-call basis and so forth, but I've only been involved in a couple of times in situations that where you need to get access. But then one of those times, finding the physician out of town for an extended period of time and the on-call physician in surgery leaves you a little bit of a state of flux of where you go from there.
Well,
you get pretty far down the chain of things when you have to go again to try to then get a third party to backing up a doctor in surgery. So it gets to be a little problematic, and I can testify that it's not terribly consoling. Even to somebody that probably has the nerve to push phone calls and go ahead with things like myself, dedicated enough to know a little bit about the procedure, but it might be very frustrating to somebody trying to receive care over a period of time.
Mr. Chairman, while I will admit that there is no perfect system designed, if there is a true emergency with, let's say, a significant object in one's eye, I would presume, maybe incorrectly, that would be taken care of in a very sophisticated medical circumstance in any case, which is far beyond, say, having some dirt under one's eyelid. Big difference.
Mm-hmm. I think about Silverton. I just wonder if they have an ophthalmologist on call on the weekends at that hospital.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Shannon, I can't answer that specifically. I can find out for you if you wish.
Okay, we have three other folks that wish to testify. John Powell, Dave Fishman, and Peggy Anna.
Chairman, for the record, my name is John Powell, representing Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon. Mr. Chairman, you were handed, I think, a letter by the previous witnesses that outlined some of our objections to the Dash Sixth Amendment on a memo dated April 30th and signed by seven of us. The again, the number of visits has been lengthened to four, a follow-up after the initial visit, which we think goes far beyond, quote, an emergency. And remind the committee that last session in Senate Bill 21, emergency room services are covered under the prudent layperson rule that if you think it's an emergency, that would be covered under your health insurance policy. So if one has a true emergency of eye care and it is indeed an emergency, they have coverage under that prudent layperson coverage. So we would oppose the Dash 6 Amendment. The Dash 7 Amendment, as was pointed out by Ms. Fisher, the amendments do not delete the first portion of the bill, which is lines 14 through 24, that includes such things as equal reimbursement and other things that I don't think even the proponents of the bill, I think, have deleted those sections. So, the Dash 7 Amendment, while closer to something that's feasible, runs short in that regard. And again, we would simply state for the record that we do not believe that there is any kind of a crisis in this area, and would just ask the committee not to pass Senate Bill 16. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Dave Stiffson, representing Providence Health Plans as well as Pacific Care. I will say ditto to Mr. Powell. We're not in favor of the bill, nor the Dash 6 amendments, the Dash 7 amendments, in the spirit of the words already uttered by Mr. Powell and Ms. Fisher come far closer to a compromise that we could live with. And I would like to compliment you, Mr. Chair, on your efforts to produce these amendments. We worked hard with the Optometric Association in an attempt to reach agreement, and I believe that substantially that fell apart for reasons associated with the four-visit follow-up as contained in the Dash 6 amendments. We simply can't live with that. And I think with that, I'll stop. We'll be open to questions in a moment, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Peggy Annett, and I'm representing the Health Insurance Association of America. When we started on this bill, it was our assumption that the intention was to address emergency situations. The more that we met with the optometry folks, we realized that, in fact, the issues were much broader than that, and what they really were requesting was direct access to optometrists for medical treatment of the eye outside of the managed care plan provisions. And that really was what the heart of it was, which was something that, of course, we have objected to in terms of the direct access provision. We can live with an emergency access provision. The only other thing that I would comment was that I did ask HIA's actuary to review the cost report that was presented by the optometrist, and what they found was that the assumptions were weak in terms of the cost savings, because they did not find at this stage that direct access with a referral is commonly required, and so the cost assumptions that the optometrist used assumed that the savings would be generated as a result of not having to go to your primary care provider to get the subsequent referral. And so in that, and even the cost assumptions or the conclusions that they presented pretty much showed that the cost data were a wash. And if you take a look and examine the assumptions, one would conclude that, in fact, there really were no savings that one would assume to be generated by eliminating this referral process. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay, questions. If we did the Dash 7 with the deletion of lines 14 to 24, say that is a livable situation?
Speaking on behalf of HIA, I could live with that, Mr. Chair. But the other folks would have to, of course, speak for themselves.
And Mr. Chair, for Providence and Civic Care, the answer is yes. Mr. Chairman, for Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon, while, again, our statement in truth is we do not believe it's necessary, it would definitely be better than the excess.
One other question. In your opinion, how many times would, or what percentage, or would you have any idea of a percentage that a primary care physician would probably not agree or not order the follow-up to go ahead and go through the optometrist anyway if he had treated an emergency situation and called him? I was under the impression that a lot of these things were referred to an optometrist or an ophthalmologist anyway. By the primary care physician, he saw him first.
Chairman Senator Fisher, again, it depends, I think, on what we're talking about and where the original treatment did, in fact, occur. And if it was an emergency, a true an emergency, I don't know how many of those actually go to an optometrist for their initial treatment when somebody may be frightened about loss of vision and that sort of thing versus dirt in the eye. My household, we've had lots of those occasions where one of my family members was through the wind or something, got something in their eye. To my knowledge, through three children, the youngest being a senior in high school now, I never remember us ever running to an eye care professional to get something, some dirt out from under the eye. If I felt threatened enough to think that it would have a potential for vision loss, I would go to a hospital where if, in fact, emergency surgery or anything like that was necessary to get that kind of service.
Others have comments?
Mr. Chair, I'm not a good person to ask because my husband only has one eye already. So there's no question as to where he was going to be going. In fact, I have discussed this bill with him, and in his case, clearly, he feels very strongly about seeing an ophthalmologist.
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure I understand exactly your question. I would concur with my colleagues and say that in the negotiations that your staff led us through over the last weeks, we were toying with, after the emergency care visit, having language in the legislation that would have allowed insurers to impose reasonable limits on the number of unreferred follow-up visits, words to that effect. It turned out that we could not reach agreement, and the number was four, and we were interested in providing emergency care because we think that our follow-up visits may be appropriate and necessary. At the same time, if the problems are such as my colleagues described, I too would go to an emergency room of the hospital, especially on a weekend.
Okay, thank you very much. Wayne, you want to come back up and just ask a question here for you? Senator Shannon, did you?
Well, I just wanted to know what your response was to the Dash 7.
Senator Fisher, Chair.
No, you just saw him, probably.
Senator Shannon, thank you. Again, for record, my name is Wayne Schumacher with the Oregon Optometric Association. Again, the Dash 7 amendment attempts to address an emergency-only visit. Our concern is that an emergency is not well-defined. Even under the prudent man rule, there still tends to be confusion in the healthcare industry. An individual should feel fairly sure, we think, that they can go to an eye care practitioner and get something taken care of without having to first determine themselves whether this is an emergency visit or not. Emergency visits to me means I go to the emergency room. It's a life-threatening issue. And in fact, most of the managed organizations I've been connected with, and I was at one time the marketing director of PacifiCare, we felt that there better be blood and evidence or it wasn't an emergency. And in fact, I think they've had their hands slapped with regard to that. So again, there's some confusion to the patient, and that's where our concern is. And again, they're suggesting deleting, I believe it was, section, or basically line 14 through 24, and we're still concerned with the fact that through 14 through 16, if we don't at least have some provision that this is not an ophthalmology optometry fight here. The eye care practitioners need to be listed on the panel that's distributed to the members. Otherwise, again, they may find themselves misdirecting themselves into a non-member provider, again, not being reimbursed for the issue, being cost-wise with the system. We feel Dash 6 allows the member the most clearest avenue to treatment. And we're getting an initial visit and a follow-up of maybe one to four more to make sure that eye is in the is healing, and if it's not, to get them referred on, again, refer them back to the PCP, get them referred on to where they need to be. In the case of ophthalmology, they cannot always take care of it themselves. It has to be referred to actually a subspecialist within ophthalmology.
Wayne, you're talking here now about access to eye care.
Right, sir.
That was not the thing that was brought to my attention that regarded this Senate Bill 16. Senate Bill 16 was presented as a situation where you have a person that has determined he has an emergency and he winds up in your office to have something done to his eye, only to have to try to go through the rigmarole of contacting a primary care physician to get him over there. Now you're talking and broadening that out to a whole different subject here, at least in my opinion. And this answers to the emergency. You have the guy in the chair. He's figured it's an emergency. He's made that decision already. He didn't have to call somebody and say, is this an emergency or not? He came to your place with something that was affecting his eyesight in some way or another that he felt was enough that he needed to get off the diamond and come in and present himself to you. That was presented in a way that these were emergency situations where, generally speaking, there was something in the eye or I don't know, even maybe a pink eye situation. I just happened to have a young friend of my grandson here just last weekend, the weekend before this one. Wound up and apparently Friday night he realized that he had some problems and had to go in on Saturday with a real good case of pink eye. And yet he was there. He didn't, you know, he knew he needed to go and so forth. So these are the type of things that we were attempting to address, not an access to eye care situation. And so if we had this emergency in there, it's been described here and put on record that emergency would include over weekends or holidays that were in conjunction with weekends and that type of thing, so that a reasonable judgment could be made as to access to other avenues that are spelled out in the thing. And I am leaning very strongly toward that decision myself, because I feel that answers what originally we set out here to do and takes care of that problem.
Senator Fisher, members of the committee, I guess your example points out exactly what we're trying to point out in 6. In the case of pink eye, is that an emergency visit? I would submit to you that under the prudent man rule, it's not an emergency visit. And that individual now would be crosswise with the system of having self-referred themselves to their member provider. And in fact, it wasn't an emergency visit. So that's why we would like to steer you away from emergency. Emergency, again, is a very subjective term. And what we're concerned about is the urgency situation, which is exactly what you've described. An urgent situation where I've got something in my eye, it may be painful. It's not life-threatening. We don't have blood present. What's the prudent man rule under this? And that's what we're concerned about. We think that limitation to visit, is probably the best way to deal with this. So I would suggest Senator Fisher.
Well, my wife arrived at an emergency room and had no trouble getting in, and she didn't have blood present either, but she had a broken wrist.
Senator Fisher. But that's what my question is under dash 7, if a person found their child had pink eye Saturday morning, would you have to go through the expense of renting an emergency room and paying for a doctor to look at them? Or could you go to an optometrist with pink eye on Saturday morning?
Well, my understanding is what it, at least what I designed now, he's throwing in a word urgent instead of emergency. And I don't know that we've got urgent defined any better anywhere in law than we do in
Well, it doesn't matter if we have. If the HMOs define emergency as blood or a broken bone, then that's who pays the bill.
Senator Fisher and Senator Shannon, exactly the issue. Each HMO tends to have their own definition of emergency care. We feel urgent care really is a much more encompassing term, and therefore probably least likely to be confused as far as the intent of the bill. Again, we think that the limitation in 6, as far as visitation is concerned, probably provides the member the best possible avenue and probably the clearest signal to the carriers, too, as to what they should allow, as opposed to having some suggestive terms such as emergency services.
I'm going to, on my own, ask to have this redrafted and take out line 14 to 24 and combine it with the emergency situation here on an emergency basis and bring that back on Wednesday.
And not use the word urgent. We need to explore that.
Why don't we discuss it briefly after this with the folks involved, if the word urgent seems to be a reasonable word to put in. I don't have an objection to that, but let's get it taken care of by Wednesday, and I'll again have to follow through on this on Wednesday.
That's the Sixth Amendment.
Well, it wouldn't be part of it because they're not including lines 14 through 24 in the... I also want to acknowledge a letter here from City of Portland, Senate Bill 16, and they're concerned that as it's written, could have some problems with, cause them problems with their primary or their insurance coverage on their health plan. So we'll introduce that into testimony. Close the work session on a public hearing on Senate Bill 16 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1097. Go as fast as we can go here before we get to. We have the additional amendment to Senate Bill 1097. Where does this go? Okay. Ronell Shankel, Kevin Aguirre, and Alice Fairland. Testimony is short. Yeah, I hate to be doing this, but we're trying to get wound up here on these bills and still do some type of justice to the process here, and I apologize for being a bit hurried.
For the record, I'm Ronell Shankel with the Department of Justice Support Enforcement Division here today on behalf of Oregon's Child Support Program. I can be fairly brief in my comments. Child Support Program provides services to establish paternity and establish child support orders for families in Oregon. We work with both the custodial and the non-custodial parents in these endeavors. We do not directly deal with the issues of custody and visitation, Although for the customers that we serve, the issues are all often tied together for them. We are here today neutral on this bill. We support the concept, but we had requested one very minor technical amendment, which I think you have before you today as the -2 amendment, that just further clarifies should the commission be taking some action that conflicts in any manner, not only with federal regulations, but the amendment would expand it to state laws and rules that we, of course, would have to follow those laws or regulations.
Well, that's the whole idea of state law, isn't it?
Chair Fisher, I believe so.
We can't affect federal law, basically, or... And you say the -2 amendments?
Chair Fisher, yes.
And they're pulling through.
I believe the -2 amendments are also reflected in the hand and gross copy that you have before you today.
Okay. Senator Fisher?
Yes,
sir. Is this supported by the original sponsors of the
bill? We'll find that out immediately. I wanted to...
Because I was thinking maybe we could move it if they supported it, because they're already asked for a call to Senate.
Yeah. Go ahead and quickly.
For the record, my name is Kevin Aguirre. I'm Assistant Administrator of Adult and Family Services. We did want to point out some difficulties that we have with the bill as written, and we certainly have no problem with non-custodial parents having more say in children's and families' issues. In fact, we encourage it, but there are some difficulties. The first thing is the single perspective makeup of the committee and also the funding arrangement. We have such things as welfare review commissions now. The difference there is that those are independent bodies who secure their own funding, and they're also made up from multiple perspectives, so that the commissions are designed to give input and advice to the agency on public assistance programs, but they are made up purposely from a wide variety of perspectives and opinions to give the best possible advice and not just from a single focus. The second thing that we have some difficulties with is the funding mechanism that they propose in the bill to use what is the federal PAIDS grant to fund the commission. And I would point out the testimony that I passed out with the green cover, and that the PAIDS grant, the purpose of the grant is to facilitate non-custodial parents' access to and visitation of their children by means of activities, including mediation, counseling, etc. In other words, as we view the requirements of the grant, it is to provide direct service and services for access and visitation issues, and we do not see any mechanism in the grant to fund a commission. The second thing is that on the second page you show what we are also right now contractually committed with the grant through the end of this year to provide the services on page 2 of establishing parenting plans, mediation services, and enforcement of the parenting plans. And then the rest of the testimony follows of the fatherhood programs that are now in place either in pilot form that ourselves in conjunction with Support Enforcement Division and our jobs and workforce partners are working right now that are designed in the best interest of the child, that in the absence of safety concerns, the philosophy of these programs is that the child's best interest is served when they have both the financial and emotional support of both of the parents to the extent that that's possible. And the written testimony goes on to describe that the programs, and then at the end you see a brochure of a program that's just now starting up in the Marion County area that's dealing with non-custodial fathers who are in correctional facilities, both to make them aware of their responsibilities and after they become parolees to allow them access to education and training activities to help them secure employment and be able to pay their child support.
What's the direction of the PAID grant going to take after December 1999, or is that the end of it?
No, we actually just received word from the federal government that there is another round of PAID grant coming for next year. It has the same requirements, though, of how the money can be spent, and we are just now asking to to bring together a representative group of stakeholders to help us, to advise us on what we should do with that grant. And on this round, we are going to go out for a request for proposal to administer the funds pursuant to the requirements of the grant. In other words, we will be asking for proposals to be submitted by service providers.
Would those rules and regulations permit something that's what's being proposed here by Bill 1096?
We do not believe it does. As we read the grant, there does not appear to be a provision to fund a commission, but more to provide service, to access and visitation services to both custodial and non-custodial parents.
Senator Duncan.
Mr. Chair, if we do nothing on this bill, what happens? What you're doing.
Well, what we were going to propose, and it's in the -3 amendments, and actually we were going to do this whether there's legislation or not, but what we want to do is set up a task force, because again, we do agree with non-custodial parents that they should have and need to have more say and advice into public assistance programs, particularly those that affect children and families. And we would propose to set up a task force to specifically look at agency access and visitation issues. And that's what we're going to do.
Okay, you're going to do that on your own, whether we have this bill or not.
Yes.
Go ahead, yeah. Senator.
I'm not sure what happened to this call. The Senator, I thought we were under, but
we are under what?
Are we? We just haven't sent the guards. Is it your suggestion that we do -2 and -3, or just -3, or is it beneficial just to let this bill drop and do nothing, or? I'm just asking for some clarification. Is that what you're asking for, Senator Duncan?
I think that was what I was trying to answer.
So what's your response to this?
Well, our response is that we recommend the -3 amendments because we do think there's difficulties with the way the bill is drafted with the funding mechanism, and I know the proponents of the bill would like to have a commission, but in my discussions with some of them, they would agree to this as a fallback plan to be able to have a more formal say and mechanism to give advice on to the agency on programs that affect access and visitation issues.
Okay.
Hi, I'm Alice Phelan, and I work with the Oregon Judicial Department, and I will hope to be very brief. My first comment is on the -1 amendments, and I discussed this with Lane Barlow and the other presenters of the bill. In -1, they have presented that the Chief Justice would appoint 2 members to this committee. Because of the contemplated responsibilities of the commission, which are to administer and make decisions on funding decisions, this would not be appropriate because under the Oregon Constitution, Article 3, separation of powers, the judicial branch should not be acting on decisions in the executive branch. And we've informed Lane Barlow of that decision on our behalf. We have said that the Chief Justice has said certainly he is interested in cooperating with the intent of this commission, and I could say that he would be interested in cooperating with the task force. Thank you.
How under the gun are we? Really under the gun for sure?
Yeah.
Okay, well, we'll take this very short then. For the record, Lane Barlow, Oregon Men's Association, if it's -3 or nothing, let's get this thing moved out of here. Let's do it now. Of course, people have presented some problems with the bill, so it do need to be addressed. Our first choice is that your hand in growth passes with the one caveat, the appointments are exclude the Chief Justice and the Judiciary from it. 3 appointments would be each by the Governor, President of the Senate, and Speaker of the House. If the committee is so inclined, we got to get this thing out of here. Let's just do the -3s and get it out.
Okay, Lane, I would suggest that, and then if there's modifications that we can make in the House,
yeah.
Work on it further, that would be for us.
We'd be very happy. Let's get this out of here.
Are we in work session?
Yes.
Yes?
Oh, I'm sorry. No, I will vote for the hearing and open work session on Senate Bill.
Chair, I do. Can I agree amendments?
Senator Shields would move the day three amendment. Senator Castillo.
Well, it sounds like we're already doing this, and so I'm wondering if we actually need this bill. We just heard that we're doing it, so why do we need to do this?
Is it we are or we're going to?
That we are. Or we're going to.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
So I'm just wondering why we need to do this, if we're going to do this anyway.
Well, this would ensure that it gets done, and that's part of the problem that sometimes happen if you don't have it down.
We endorse that view.
Further discussion? Senator Duncan.
Well, I just hate cluttering it with the laws. Just hoping it's going to be done. That's what bothers me a little bit. If they're going to do it, they're going to do it.
This also guarantees where the makeup's coming from and that kind of thing. And that's
If I may, Senator Duncan, mm-hmm. Yeah, we need it in writing if they're going to do it. And that's
it in the notes.
That's a bit more.
Yeah, that and the cover.
Well, call roll. You can do this thing.
Senator Dashley.
Yes.
Aye.
Senator
Shields.
Aye.
Senator
Castillo.
Aye.
No.
I move that Senate bill.
Motion carries.
Oh, yeah. Now, go ahead and move it to the floor.
Okay. Was it due pass?
With a due, I forgot the number.
1097
to the floor, as amended with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Shannon moves Senate bill 1097 with the -3 amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Further discussion? Objection. We'll go call the roll.
Aye. Senator Castillo?
Aye.
Senator Duncan?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Motion carries. Senator Shannon will carry the bill. Thank you very much, and I adjourn the Senate Committee on Health and Human Services, and the Senate Bill 1202 I will also attempt to carry over to Wednesday and finish it up. Mm-hmm.